Hello there and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and the very best of the week's culture from across the island and around the world. Coming up this time, Cork-based Australian cellist Isla Desire on the slow business of finding a place for the cello in Irish traditional music. And we visit an exhibition at TCD offering a history of military hardware invading the Afghan rug. But we begin this time with a musical struggle. Sean Clancy's most recent release has the composer slipping away from his familiar role. He describes some musical materials, but leaves what exactly they might add up to with the performers who'll take on the work. It's an approach which might almost as much be about a philosophy as a musical strategy. One constant inspiration for the composer is his, let's call it, interest in numbers and count, such as in his 14 minutes of music on the subject of greeting cards, or his 11 lines of music slow down and eventually stop, or even his 10 minutes of music on the subject of IKEA. Sean Clancy talked to Culture File about his latest piece, Four Sections of Music Equally Divided, and began by talking about that special relationship with numbers.
It's a weird one. It's definitely been in a lot of music that I've written. I always just remember counting. I don't know when it started. It just kind of seems to be in a thing that I've done as long as I can remember. Like, I remember kind of counting how many steps it would take me to get between slabs of concrete on the street outside my house. And it drives my wife mad because I count, like, you know, how many counts I do to wash dishes and how many counts it takes me to kind of get from point A to point B, or how long something should last for. I'm basically always counting. There's a composer, a British composer called Leo Chadburn, and he wrote a piece for a group called Decibel, which is run by the Irish composer Ed Bennett. They did a piece of Leo's, I think about 2 or 3 years ago, which I saw. And in it, it was a piece for ensemble and a kind of a tape track narrator. And the tape track narrator was Leo going 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4. And it was like being inside my mind. And I said to Leo afterwards, I said, that's exactly what my life is like. It's basically just anytime I'm not like actively speaking or actively thinking, I'm basically counting.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
So it's measures. It's not sort of open-endedly counting to infinity. You're counting measures all the time.
Yeah, it depends on the situation. Like when I'm running, for example, I run about 3 or 4 times a week. I'm running for about 25, 26 minutes. And in that situation, I count to, I usually get to, like, you know, 1,200 or something like that. The ways it's kind of fed into music over the years is that I suppose a lot of the music that I wrote up until around 2017 or thereabouts was very strictly measured, and time signatures were changing all the time, and you were getting these situations where you would have counts like 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, and you'd have things like that going all the time. And in a way, that was kind of externalizing or translating what was going on in my mind, I suppose, what kind of happened to me. You know, since around 2017, it started causing me a lot of stress and a lot of anxiety, and I kind of had to distance myself from what was going on here to what I was asking other people to do.
It seems like when in the new piece, you're almost answering yourself in how far away you get from that. So it's four sections of music and equally divided. Is like that's a top-down kind of look. What's going on beneath that is freer, I guess.
Yeah, it's much, much freer. This was one of the first kind of pieces. I think it's probably the second piece I wrote where I kind of made a conscious decision to really kind of open things up and enable much more agency from the people that are performing the music. In this recording that just came out a couple of weeks ago, I'm playing it, but it's been performed by other people. I've performed it with professional musicians, I've performed it with students, I've performed it with people who aren't necessarily musicians. It was a kind of, I suppose, an exercise in doing something that I was excited to do, but also gave a lot of agency to the people that I would be doing it with, instead of me kind of saying, everything must be like this, everything must be super strict, everything must be on this beat and that beat, and you must interlock with those people. The only thing that's fixed in it really are, there's some pitches that are fixed, but they're ordering, or you know, how it might be in counterpoint with one person or another person, is not fixed. And there's no indication of whether the work is sequential or if it's simultaneous. So you could have section one, section two, section three, and section four all happening simultaneously, in which case the piece would be like 13 minutes or something.
And loud.
Or it could be completely sequential as it is in this example.
I guess when you've recorded it, people will assume that that way you've played it is something close to canon.
When I was much younger, I really liked getting recordings of composers performing their own music. When I was like 17 or 18 and getting into music in a big way, like, you know, contemporary classical music, I kind of felt that was like, you know, the most authentic, inverted commas, way of hearing the piece. Specifically, just popped into my mind, there's a recording of Luciano Berio's Labyrinthus 2. And I remember listening to the recording and thinking it was great. And yeah, it was Berio conducting and it was super. And this is like kind of the definitive recording. And then I saw a performance in the Living Music Festival in Dublin in 2003. And it was so much more energetic, and it was so much more kind of cool improvisation, and the narration I preferred. I think it was Terry Edwards was narrating it. It was so much better, and Berio had kind of no involvement in the performance of it at all. So then I kind of started thinking, and I was in first year in college or something, and started questioning about, you know, whether a composer's interpretation is the best. And I think now I know enough really amazing musicians, and most people I know would do a much better job on this piece than,
There is something kind of quite zeitgeisty about collaborative creativity in general, that like we, as you're suggesting, we are sort of more and more uncomfortable, and it happens in film as well, and it happens in all sorts of art forms, where we kind of give somebody the designation of the hero of the project, and it's not completely appropriate, it's just a way of selling it, maybe, in a way.
Yeah, there's lots of reasons for it, I'm sure. Like in one respect, it's easier to say one person is responsible for this, and particularly in, I suppose, Western society, the society in a way structured in that kind of hierarchical kind of situation. We're kind of conditioned to kind of think about this one figure that's kind of largely responsible for things, you know, happens in universities, happens in private business. But the thing is that the most successful things generally come from collaboration, don't they? You know, even if one person does kind of take the lion's share of responsibility for them, most things are a collaborative effort. And I think the interesting thing happens is when you start foregrounding that as a process, that you don't just take it for granted that there is going to be a collaborative thing happening here, but that you're actually foregrounding it and you're purposely observing the collaborative process and what impact each individual has in that.
That's the thing that sort of is exciting about, you know, a kind of a moment when collaboration is given more credence and centrality, is that you kind of wonder, does that feed backwards into the world that we make? You know, it must feed backwards into the sound of the music we make, but, you know, then what else is possible?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I remember talking to one of my colleagues, and we were kind of, there was some kind of heated discussion between the students about, you know, what they were going to do for their project. And my colleague just turned to me and he said, look, if they can't decide what color to paint the wall? How are we going to decide, you know, how food should be distributed, or how these much bigger problems that exist in society? Now, obviously, art is it's essential. You know, we need it as much as we need food. So I don't want to kind of say that it's not as important as food. But the idea that if you can solve problems as a community in an artistic piece, then there's potential that you can solve a slightly larger problem. And then if you can solve that slightly larger problem, there's potential that you can solve this much bigger problem, you know, a little bit further down the line. What's interesting, I think, about collaboration or collaborative practice, having a little bit more foreground in artistic areas, is that conversely, what's happening in society is people are becoming more insulated and we're becoming less open to the other. You know, it's basically, oh, if you don't completely agree with this thing that I think, then you're kind of my opposite. If you think this way, then it's wrong or it's evil or whatever. And people don't listen as much as maybe we did in the past. And maybe this is kind of a way out of it. Maybe if we have a generation of people who are trained in collaborative practices or have engaged in collaborative practices for a number of years, that maybe in 10 years from now, there's a realization that, yes, it is difficult to do things together, but we kind of have to.
You're quite sort of concerted and dogmatic even in the way you consume new music. Like, you're really determined to consume only what's new and move on and try and cover everything.
Yeah.
Tell us about the process there.
I basically, the way I look at it is that there's so many people making music and making really great music. I think, like, you know, it's total cliche, but it's a golden age of music. You know, there's so much fantastic music out. So I basically try, this again kind of goes with my counting situation. I buy probably about 12 to 15 albums a month, usually from Bandcamp, but sometimes in record shops. And if there's something I really kind of want on record, I'll kind of get it from a shop. And then I put it on a playlist that goes on my phone. And I'll listen basically to an album five times. There's a kind of set thing. So it'll go, you know, album A, album B, album C, album D, one play, album A, album B, one play. And I'll do that five times. And then basically things move in and out of rotation on the playlist. So it's the playlist has got about 50 hours of music. And I think I probably listen to music for about 10 or 11 hours a day. I feel that it's, you know, it's my responsibility to do this. You know, it's my responsibility to know what other people are doing, well, first of all, just to kind of hear and see what's out there and kind of celebrate it. But also how I fit into this conversation, you know. Again, it's that kind of idea of we're involved in a communal process, even if we're not actively working together on a project, you know. And it's just really exciting to hear what's going out there. And it's just because there's so much out there and algorithm takes care of so much listening habits, you kind of have to fight against that a little bit. It's tricky, you know. Again, this is one of the things, you know, the more we can support each other as musicians and artists and creators and composers, whatever, the better the kind of musical ecosystem is, you know.
And there was a Bette Davis film that involves a violinist, and he's chatting with Bette Davis at some stage, and he says, oh, I never go to concerts. Why not? Well, you know, if they're better than me, then I'd be jealous, and if they're worse than me, then I'd be angry. And that's kind of like, I roughly feel that what everybody else is doing is kind of like slightly disturbing in one way or another.
Yeah, like I really love what everybody else is doing, you know. It's one of the very finest things about music is that it's a situation where you can kind of get inside somebody else's head for 10 minutes or 20 minutes or 45 minutes or however long the piece is. You're really kind of getting a sense of what this person is about, you know, and how they experience the world. That's, you know, why I love it so much. You know, it's that kind of, it's that sense of really experiencing the other, because I think often we're reserved, not everybody, but some people are reserved about their actual thoughts, you know. They obfuscate their thoughts, you know, or they kind of, they play around, you know, they don't quite say what they mean all the time. You know, there's some people that are not like that, they're the complete opposite. But my experience with people generally is that you never get the full picture. There's always something that's kind of held off or held back, you know, and whether that's, you know, people have a sunny disposition and they kind of keep the darkness out, you know, or the opposite, or, you know, there's a piece of people that you never fully understand or fully get. But music is kind of the exception to that rule. I think when you hear a piece, you get a sense of what that other person's experience of the world is. And that's a beautiful thing, you know, that's a really great thing. It's why it's so important for us all.
That was Sean Clancy there, and if you'd like to get started on listening to every single piece of new music ever released, his latest is Four Sections of Music Equally Divided, and it's in all the streaming places.
The Aesthetics of Chaos is the title of an exhibition at TCD this week, featuring rugs created by Afghani women which trace in wool the impact of the waves of war that have convulsed their homeland. The so-called war rugs are part of a collection of the Iranian rug expert and curator Saman Khodeya Rifad, shown here for the first time in Europe. Culture Files' Quiva Lavelle went to see the war rugs at TCD and to meet the curator, as well as TCD's Gillian Wiley.
They are things of beauty, particularly when you're at a distance from them. And as you come closer, you realise you're looking at mines and aeroplanes and drones and tanks. I'm Gillian Wiley, and I work in the School of Religion, Theology and Peace Studies in Trinity College Dublin.
I'm Saman. I studied corporate business and corporate design in Kasha University, and after that start to collect rugs, antique rugs from Iran, and after that in a while I start to collect some Afghan war rugs, actually since 2017, and now I have a collection of 21 we can say rare Afghan war rugs in this exhibition.
A friend of Saman's knew about his collection of war rugs and knew that he wanted to have the chance to display them in Europe. So the friend, Gabriel, approached us and we said yes, we'd love to try and help to bring these rugs to Dublin. Yep, it was an adventure after that, the shipping of rugs from Afghanistan, bringing Saman from Iran, but it's been a wonderful experience.
The first phase, which is started early of the 80s, carpets, some weaponry emerged in tradition carpets, and it's lasted until like 2-3 years. And the market demands from Soviet tourists and global markets make it a little bit bigger. Actually, I think we can look at these carpets in different angles, and I try to help people and viewers to read these carpets in different ways, with putting some pictures, paintings, and maps, descriptions about Afghanistan history. But in my opinion, the most important part for me is their beauty. And the second phase, with a saturation of a global market, happened at the middle of the 80s until the American invasion, actually. And in this period, the structure of carpets still remain, but motifs replaced with weaponry instead of planet and animals, such as a rug you see there. These carpets depicting horrifying war scenes and transforming that sense and artillery is too beautiful and for me lovely motifs. But and the other point is how women can be afflicted of war and how they can help their family during the war with creating things that is really sad, actually. You know, when you see a tank with a really great details then that we can recognize its model, so we can consider that that tank could be just a few meters away from the weavers. At the first of the third phase, which started at the after the 9/11, some carpets made in manufactured in Pakistan by Afghan refugees with the order of American carpet businessmen. And after a short while, it became really different. So now, at the end of the story, we just have carpets with nomadic pattern again, with just a few small weaponry, like when it starts.
As Saman says, they are things of beauty in many respects, and particularly when you're at a distance from them, you see the beautiful colours, the symmetrical patterns, the intricate work is obvious. And as you come closer, you realise you're looking at mines and aeroplanes and drones and tanks, and they become quite, kind of profoundly moving and shocking in many ways when you see how saturated they are with images of weaponry, and it makes you ponder the impact on society and on the women's lives of being surrounded by weaponry. So I find as I get closer, I find them more upsetting than beautiful, but they have elements of them both for sure.
The ones with depicting actually cities and landscape is really interesting to me, because we don't have such things in Iran. We have those parts in like 100 years ago for a while, but having concepts of city and urban design in tribes rug is really important for me, and it's really beautiful.
I enjoy the ones that still incorporate some of the animal motifs. There's one with a mystical creature in it that's half human, half horse, and then there are some with lions. So each of them does then incorporate other artillery type motifs as well. But I enjoy the kind of juxtapositions, I suppose, of these different kinds of motifs in the carpets.
I think we got an enthusiastic reception from people who came. We hope we can get more people. Yeah, it's the first time in Europe. It's the first time for this collection and generally in Europe for war rugs. I hope, actually, because we got some offer from different countries and different people to bring the collection to their countries and their even universities. We hope to get wider viewers for this collection, and also I hope that I can work on a catalog we made. Actually, it's a kind of book, it's a small book actually. I hope we can work on it and make it bigger and be a pilot to reading all the carpets and oriental carpets, especially war rugs.
Saman Khodea-Rifad there, and you heard also from Gillian Wiley. Quiva Lavelle was the reporter. The cello isn't just for the concert hall, you know, and given there's enough headroom and a musician such as cellist Ilse Desire, it can find its place in a session too. Desire spent many years working out where a cello might fit into Irish traditional music, which involved plenty of session playing, but also a years-long journey into the tunes, which she charts in the film Living the Tradition. For the film, Desire and director Martin Roos travelled Ireland in search of the secrets of 10 airs, aiming to record each in the setting in which it was written. Culturefile's Vanessa Noonan connected with the pair in a low-carbon fashion to hear about their voyage into trad cello.
¶¶ I'm Ilse Desire.
I'm Martin Roos.
And we've made a film in 2013. We started this film, and it's called Living the Tradition. And we travelled around Ireland, and I played the cello in the places where the airs originated. So I wrote and arranged 10 Irish airs. And the film is the journey, meeting people and talking about each of the airs and looking at the history behind each of them. An air is a song or a slow song, and originally the songs would be particularly in Sean Noss style singing, and they have a lot of ornamentation, and so it's a very simple melody, but it would be repeated and twisted around with ornamentation, so you really get a beautiful expressive piece. I think that when I was sitting down and arranging these pieces, the biggest thing I was searching for was trying to emulate sounds of different things. Like, I loved the sound of an Ilian pipe playing Carrick Fergus, and I was like, oh, that sounds great. How can I do that? Then I, like, discovered on the cello that, oh, to get that sound of the Ilian pipe, if I put a drone underneath and just get this little bit out of tune, but keep going on that note and, you know, just get the right sound, then I could emulate a sound of it. And when I listen to the Sean Noss singers, someone doing it, and it's like, oh, okay, that's how those ornaments work, and I'll try and create that on the cello. So then I was like, oh, wow, okay. I go along to a session and I pull out my few tunes that I'd learned when I was a kid. And some people were, like, in the early days, they were sort of shocked. And there was quite a lot of, like, a negative reaction when I'd first sit in. And then just here and there. But then other places I'd go and they'd go, wow, cello. So gradually I've learnt, like, what's the role of the cello in the session. And you do have to be careful because the cello can be very, very powerful. So you can easily overrun the sound of everything else in some ways if you're too heavy-handed, especially like on fiddle, you know, the bowing and the light-handedness. You really have to try and emulate that on the cello to get that light sound, especially if you're playing the tunes. You know, it's a new skill, relatively new skill in Ireland that there'd be cellists in sessions. So you have to be really in tune and very flexible with the harmony and riding through without getting in anyone's way.
Ilse Desire there on Finding Room in Irish Traditional Music for her cello. And that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more unexpected timbres next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.